And welcome to our final Trail Went Cold episode of 2023. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and if you grew up watching Unsolved Mysteries, you'll probably recognize that music we just played, as it always preceded the sound of Robert Stack's voice uttering the iconic word, update. Yes, it is now time for the Trail Went Cold's fourth special update episode, in which we'll be discussing cases that we once featured on this podcast and have now either been solved or had some major developments this past year. We released our first special update episode at the start of 2020, which was episode number 155. Our second one, which was episode number 257, came out at the end of 2021. And we completed an update trilogy when we dropped episode number 310 back on January the 4th of this year. I've said this many times before, but when we started The Trail Went Cold nearly 8 years ago, I thought it would be cool if maybe one or two of the cases we covered wound up being solved someday. I never imagined that we would have enough material to put together four episodes like this. And I have to say that some of the updates we've had this year were quite unexpected, and we even wound up setting a new record for the oldest case from The Trail Went Cold to be solved. I should mention right now that this episode will exclusively focus on updates and developments which took place in 2023, so if you want to learn about cases which were solved prior to this year, I'd recommend going back and listening to our previous updates on episodes number 155, 257, and 310. Anyway, without any further ado, let us now begin The Trail Went Cold's fourth official update episode. So I just mentioned in the intro that earlier this year, The Trail Went Cold set a new milestone for the oldest cold case featured on a podcast, which wound up being solved. And this was a missing persons case that was nearly a full century old, and I'm talking about the 1930 disappearance of two-year-old Mary Agnes Maroney, which was covered over 6 years ago on episode number 41. Mary Agnes lived in Chicago with her parents, Michael and Catherine Maroney, and she had an 11-month younger sister. Catherine was also 7 months pregnant with her third child, and since this was the Great Depression, the Maroney family was really struggling and living in poverty. One of their relatives decided to place a newspaper ad seeking financial assistance for the family, and a woman named Julia Otis soon showed up at the Maroney residence, claiming that a social worker named Mrs. Henderson had seen the ad and sent her there to help out. On May the 15th, while Michael Maroney was at work, Otis showed up at the family's residence for the second time, and offered to take Mary Agnes out shopping for some new clothing and shoes. Catherine consented to this, so Otis took Mary Agnes and left, but they never returned. The following day, the Maroneys received a letter from Otis, who said that she had taken Mary Agnes to California and would return in 2 months. This was soon followed by a second letter signed by someone named Alice Henderson, who claimed that Otis had lost both her husband and child the previous year and suffered a nervous breakdown. And while this may have motivated her to take possession of Mary Agnes, Mrs. Henderson believed that she would eventually come to her senses and return the child. But this never took place, and even though police issued a warrant to arrest Otis for kidnapping, she could not be found. A check on the name Julia Otis failed to turn up any strong leads, leading to speculation that it was a pseudonym. In 1952, a 24-year-old woman named Mary McClelland, who lived in California with her husband and three children, came forward after seeing a story about Mary Agnes's disappearance in the newspaper. Since McClelland had been adopted around the same time period when Mary Agnes went missing, she became convinced that she might be the missing child. Of course, this was long before the days of DNA testing, but a series of so-called experts examined McClelland and felt there were enough similarities with her teeth, blood type, and skull type to reach the very unscientific conclusion that she was Mary Agnes. Publicly, McClelland had an emotional reunion with the Maroney family, and it seemed like this case was solved and had a happy ending. But privately, Michael and Catherine did not really believe this woman was their long-lost daughter, though they still thought McClellan was a good person and she remained a close friend of the Moroni family. Michael passed away in 1957 at the age of 58, and his final words were reportedly, quote, "They never found my baby girl." Even though she would have a total of 8 children throughout her lifetime, Catherine fell into a deep depression after the loss of Mary Agnes, and she never really got over it before she passed away in 1962 at the age of 49. Mary McClellan died in 2005, and a few years later, Mary Agnes's surviving relatives decided to perform DNA testing, and it conclusively showed that McClellan had no genetic connection to the Moroni family and was not Mary Agnes. So over the course of nearly 8 decades, this case had done a 360 and gone from unsolved to solved, all the way back to unsolved again. Shortly after I released my Trail Went Cold episode in 2017, I received an email from Mary Agnes's nephew, Don Moroni, who had been searching for answers about what happened to his missing aunt for many years, and thanked me for keeping her story in the spotlight. Of course, my theory was that the mysterious Julia Otis was either a member of a black market adoption ring and planned to sell Mary Agnes, or she kidnapped the child because she wanted to raise her as her own. I figure that Mary Agnes probably lived out the rest of her life under a false identity, with no idea that she had been abducted from her birth family, but how would anyone be able to prove this after nearly a century? Well, this is why we should always be eternally grateful for DNA testing and genetic genealogy. On February the 17th, 2023, which, appropriately enough, just happened to be the exact 7-year anniversary of when The Trail Went Cold released its first episode, a surprising announcement was made that Mary Agnes's case had likely been solved. In June of 2022, Detective Jose Rodriguez of the Cook County Sheriff's Office was assigned the task of investigating Mary Agnes's disappearance as part of the Sheriff's Missing Persons Project, and you can imagine how daunting it might have seemed to work on an unsolved cold case that was over 90 years old. But Detective Rodriguez was really intrigued by the story and wanted to uncover some answers, and he eventually got in touch with members of the Moroni family who had uploaded samples of their DNA to the websites of genealogy companies like Ancestry.com and 23andMe. Rodriguez soon learned that the Moroni family's DNA had made an unexpected genetic connection to a woman named Lori Hart and wound up speaking to Lori's mother, Terry Arnold. Terry was the last surviving child of a deceased woman named Jeanette Burchard, who had passed away in Opa-locka, Florida on October the 20th, 2003, at the age of 75. After learning Jeanette's backstory, Detective Rodriguez thought there was a good possibility she might be Mary Agnes Moroni, and while Terry was skeptical of the whole situation, she agreed to submit a sample of her DNA for analysis. Well, in October of last year, the results came back, and it showed a genetic connection between Terry and Mary Agnes's nephew, Don Moroni, as well as other members of the Moroni family, which meant that Terry and Don were technically cousins. Even though the maternal side of Terry's family was Polish, the DNA results revealed that she was mainly Irish, much like the Moronis, which seemed to support the idea that Terry's mother, Jeanette Burchard, was Mary Agnes. The story Jeanette had always been told is that she was born in Chicago on April the 14th, 1928, and her biological father, Jean Damon, died just under 2 months later. She was raised as an only child by her mother, Jeanette Selarik, who actually got remarried to a man named John Fahey only 1 month after her husband passed away. It's unclear when their marriage came to an end, but in 1934, the elder Jeanette got married for the third time to Frank Darris, and the family soon moved from Chicago to Virginia before they permanently relocated to Florida sometime during World War II. Frank passed away in 1959, but according to Jeanette, he once told her that the woman who raised her was not her natural birth mother, but did not provide any further context about this comment. In 1946, Jeanette married a man named Edward Jennings, and they would have a son named Edward Jr. and 2 daughters named Terry and Barbara. At some point they got divorced, until Jeanette got remarried to another man named Earl Burchard, and they remained together until Earl passed away in 1989. Edward Sr., Edward Jr., and Barbara have also since passed away, and Terry remains their last surviving child. She described Jeanette as a wonderful mother who worked as a nurse for over 50 years, so by all accounts, Jeanette lived a good, happy life until her death in 2003. Jeanette's so-called mother, Jeanette Celarik, actually wound up outliving her, as she passed away in 2007 at the age of 97, but needless to say, there are a number of unanswered questions about her. When you look at the timeline, there's a good chance that the elder Jeanette was the mysterious Julia Otis and may have abducted Mary Agnes from her family and raised her as her own daughter. As you might recall, following Mary Agnes's disappearance, the Moronis had received two separate letters from Julia Otis and Alice Henderson, but it's always been suspected that Alice Henderson did not exist, and both letters were written by the same person. It's interesting how the Henderson letter mentioned that Julia Otis had lost her husband and child and suffered a nervous breakdown. It is a confirmed fact that Jeanette Celarik's husband passed away in 1928, and while there's no record of her ever having lost a child, it's possible she could have gotten pregnant and suffered a miscarriage at some point. If she felt she could no longer have children of her own, this may have prompted her to put together this elaborate ruse to abduct Mary Agnes from the Moroni family. But it's also possible that Julia Otis was a completely different person who belonged to a black market adoption ring, and that's how Jeanette took possession of Mary Agnes. After all these years, we'll probably never know the full truth. I know that Terry Arnold has struggled with the idea that the woman she believed was her maternal grandmother may have stolen her mother from her birth family, but regardless, she has still developed a close relationship with Mary Agnes's surviving relatives. She also said that if her mother had still been alive to learn this shocking revelation, she likely would have become close with the Moroni family as well. I should add the disclaimer that the Cook County Sheriff's Office cannot definitively say with absolute 100% certainty that Jeanette Burchard was Mary Agnes Moroni. In order to do this, they would have to exhume the remains of both Jeanette and Catherine Moroni and perform this new DNA testing in order to confirm a genetic match that they are mother and daughter. Terry is understandably reluctant to do this, but the genetic link between the two families has compelled them to accept the official findings, which point towards Jeanette being Mary Agnes, so the investigation is now considered to be closed. Believe it or not, this will not be the only story I discuss on this episode where a detective worked diligently to solve a cold case that was several decades old. This whole situation demonstrates that no matter how much time has passed or how old a case might be, they are never completely unsolvable and deserve to be properly investigated. So our next case is another one that I honestly did not expect to see get solved this year, and that's the 1987 murder of 6-year-old Jeremy Stoner, which I covered on the podcast 8 months ago on episode number 324. Until I started work on that episode, I had honestly never heard of the case, as my original plan was to cover the unsolved murder of 9-year-old Eric Coy, which took place in Martinez, California, on January the 24th, 1987. However, during my research, I learned that investigators had looked into possible connections between Eric's case and the murder of Jeremy Stoner, which took place 4 weeks later in the city of Vallejo, which is only 12 miles from Martinez. This case was not that well known, but I thought it was very intriguing, so I decided to cover Jeremy and Eric's murders together on the same episode. Jeremy went missing from his neighborhood on the afternoon of February the 21st, 1987, and 4 days later, his nude body was discovered in a remote area 30 miles away. The boy had been strangled to death, stabbed, and sodomized, but none of his clothing was ever found. A week and a half later, a 26-year-old suspect named Sean Quincy Melton would pop up on the radar as a suspect. Melton had always wanted to become a police officer, but was unable to do so because of issues with asthma. He was also known as an amateur sleuth who would spend his spare time investigating cold cases and liked to rub shoulders with law enforcement, and after taking an interest in solving Jeremy's murder, he walked into the Vallejo police station with an investigative report he had typed up about the crime. Of course, this immediately made the police suspicious of Melton, as he had a criminal record for misdemeanor offenses and reportedly had an explosive temper and a history of mental health issues. They proceeded to interrogate Melton for around 30 hours without the presence of an attorney, and while he never actually confessed to killing Jeremy, he supposedly revealed details about the crime which were not public knowledge, and this led to him being charged with murder, kidnapping, and molestation. Even though he was never officially diagnosed, Investigators believed that Melton was suffering from multiple personality disorder and that he abducted and murdered Jeremy when his so-called evil personality took over. Well, even though Melton was undoubtedly a strange character, there really wasn't much in the way of hard evidence linking him to Jeremy's murder, and his wife provided him with an alibi, claiming they were at the movies together during the time period Jeremy went missing. Regardless, Melton still went on trial in June of 1988, but after deliberating for 6.5 days, the jury found themselves hopelessly deadlocked with a vote of 7-5 in favor of acquittal, so a mistrial was declared. The state proceeded to take Melton to trial for a second time later that year, but once again, after deliberating for a week, the jury was hopelessly deadlocked. They found Melton not guilty on the molestation charge, but were stuck at a 9-3 vote in favor of acquittal on the murder and kidnapping charges, so a mistrial had to be declared again. A Superior Court judge then ruled that the evidence against Melton was not strong enough to bring him to trial for the third time, so he ordered him to be released from jail after 19 months of incarceration. If new evidence against Melton had surfaced, the state would have had the option to recharge him with Jeremy's murder and bring him to trial again, but this never occurred, and in June of 2000, Melton passed away at the young age of 38 due to complications from severe asthma. Now, this case completely faded from the spotlight, and I could find almost no media coverage about it following 1989. I just figured that law enforcement was holding on to the attitude that Melton was the killer, and since he was now dead, there was nothing more they could do, so the investigation was essentially closed. Therefore, you cannot imagine just how much my jaw dropped when I learned that an arrest had been made in this case. I was actually attending CrimeCon in Orlando in late September, and I still vividly remember being in a bar and suddenly receiving an email on my phone from a listener who informed me of this news. Since Jeremy's murder and Melton's two trials took place during the late 1980s, DNA profiling was still in its infancy and not yet being widely used in criminal investigations. As a result, none of the contemporary news coverage mentioned anything about DNA evidence, so I wasn't even sure if it existed, but it turned out that DNA belonging to the perpetrator had been collected during the original autopsy. In October of 2022, the Solano County District Attorney's Office Cold Case Unit decided to take a fresh look at this case, and within a year, DNA testing would lead them to a suspect. On September the 22nd, 2023, it was announced that 69-year-old Fred Marion Kane III had been arrested and charged with murder with special circumstances with respect to kidnapping, sodomy, and a lewd act on a child. Even though Kane was living in Central Point, Oregon at this point, he had been residing in California in 1987 and was extradited to Solano County to face the charges. Kane already had an extensive criminal history for such offenses as sodomy, rape by the use of an intoxicating substance, burglary, and in 1984, he had been arrested in San Bernardino County for raping a 17-year-old at knife point, though he was acquitted of the crime when he went on trial. Kane was not living in Vallejo at the time of Jeremy's murder, and as far as anyone can tell, he did not know the boy, so it was possible that he was just passing through the area and targeted Jeremy at random. However, Kane was interviewed as a potential suspect during the early stages of the investigation, and was going to be brought back and re-interviewed a second time, but when Sean Melton walked into the Vallejo police station and became the primary focus of the investigation, it seems like Kane pretty much slipped through the cracks. Well, not only did this new DNA analysis implicate Kane, but it finally cleared Melton of any involvement in Jeremy's murder, and the Solano County District Attorney's Office announced that he was now officially exonerated. Melton had to live under a cloud of suspicion for the rest of his life, and according to his brother, when Melton was on his deathbed, he expressed his regret that the Stoner family might never find Jeremy's real killer. Obviously, the news of Kane's arrest took the Stoners by complete surprise, since for 36 years, they were convinced that Melton was the perpetrator. It's a shame that investigators seemed to get major tunnel vision in regards to Melton, and he was railroaded based mostly on the fact that he was weird. But I do have to give major credit to Solano County District Attorney Krishna Adams for her willingness to take a fresh look at this case and find the real perpetrator, because in many cases like this, law enforcement is unwilling to admit they made a mistake and correct an injustice. As for Kane, he has been assigned a public defender and entered a plea of not guilty to this crime, and his next hearing in court is scheduled sometime in January. Investigators have also announced that Kane is being looked at as a person of interest in the murder of Eric Coy, the other case which was featured on episode number 324, so like always, I'll keep you apprised of any further developments. Anyway, our next two updates are pretty unique, because while both of these cases were profiled on The Trail Went Cold, they were technically not the main featured case in their respective episodes. In September of 2020, our podcast released episode number 190, which covered the unsolved disappearance of 34-year-old Mary Jane Van Gilder. Mary Jane was a married mother of five children who lived in Marion County, West Virginia, but in 1944, she decided to move away and relocate to Ohio and got a job at the Shelby Army Air Force Depot near the town of Shelby. She remained in the area for a year, but in March of 1945, Mary Jane quit her job at the depot and just seemed to drop out of sight, as she cut off all communication with her family. What made this particular episode so unique is that I was contacted by Mary Jane's granddaughter, who asked if I would cover this case on The Trail Went Cold, and I was also put in touch with Detective Adam Turner of the Shelby Police Department, who is actively investigating Mary Jane's disappearance. Like Detective Jose Rodriguez in the Mary Agnes Moroney case, Detective Turner held the mindset that even if a cold case was several decades old, it still deserved to be investigated. Well, one of his leads involved an unidentified decedent whose skeletal remains were found in a drainage ditch in Preble County, Ohio, on May the 25th, 1968. Even though the coroner could not determine the victim's cause of death, it was theorized that they might have been buried in a shallow grave somewhere before heavy rain and flooding hit the area, which caused the remains to be unearthed. At the time, the coroner believed that the remains belonged to a woman who was between 30 and 50 years old and may have been pregnant at some point in her life. Since she could not be identified, she became known as the Preble County Jane Doe, as well as the nickname Preble County Penny, and she was buried at Mount Hill Cemetery in the town of Eaton. When Detective Turner learned about this decedent, he wanted to explore the possibility that she could have been Mary Jane Van Gilder. And even if she was not Mary Jane, it would still be a good opportunity to figure out who this victim really was, and possibly provide answers for another family who were out there somewhere. In August of 2019, the Preble County Jane Doe was exhumed, but when her remains were turned over to the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation, they announced that since the bones degraded so much after all these years, the DNA strand had been broken, so they could not construct a full DNA profile for the victim. They also later revealed there was male DNA on the remains, though they acknowledged that the DNA could have been left by a male contributor or wound up there due to contamination. Well, in June of 2022, the Shelby Police Department partnered with an organization called Moxie Forensic Investigations, who specialized in providing investigative genetic genealogy services to identify unknown individuals. They agreed to have Preble County's remains sent to Intermountain Forensics, a nonprofit forensic DNA testing laboratory located in Salt Lake City, Utah, who specialized in extracting DNA from human remains. Even though the procedure would cost $5,000, the full funding was provided by Criminal Coffee Company, a business run by Stephanie Harlow and Derek Levasseur, who co-host the Crime Weekly podcast/YouTube show. In the end, Intermountain Forensics was able to construct a viable DNA profile for Preble County Penny, which was subsequently uploaded into GenMatch to undergo genealogical research. When a match was eventually made, the results confirmed that Preble County Penny was not Mary Jane Van Gilder, but they also revealed that the Preble County Jane Doe was actually a John Doe. Last month, on November the 17th, the Shelby PD held a press conference in which Detective Turner announced that the decedent had been positively identified as Albert Allen Frost. It sounds like the original coroner may have mistakenly identified Albert as female due to his small stature, and it goes without saying that the coroner's theory about the victim having been pregnant at some point was wildly inaccurate. The identification was made possible when Tina Barrett, the granddaughter of one of Albert's sisters, agreed to provide a sample of her DNA for a comparison to the remains, and a genetic match wound up being made. Albert Allen Frost was originally born in Hamilton, Ohio on January 25, 1935, to parents Martin Van Buren Frost and Eva Catherine Berryman Frost, and was the youngest of 8 children in their family. Albert was also a military veteran who served in the United States Army, and was so proud of his service that he would wear his military-issued army jacket virtually all the time. According to his surviving relatives, Albert was a shy but somewhat rebellious individual who did not adhere to any structure and pretty much lived a transient lifestyle. He did not seem to have a permanent home, as he would drift in and out of his family's lives and borrow money from them from time to time. Albert did have a history of trouble with the law, as he was arrested and spent time in jail for larceny on a couple of occasions, for such offenses as stealing contributions from an Easter Seals container at a tavern, and stealing his sister's table model radio. In fact, this new investigation even uncovered a newspaper article from 1961, which reported that Albert had been arrested for something, and admitted to police that he had looted over 100 cars. In January of 1959, Albert got married to a woman named Ida Cottle, but the union only lasted 14 months before they divorced, and a contemporary newspaper account listed neglect as the reason for this. It's been reported that Albert apparently had a daughter at one point, who was adopted in 1963 and had her name legally changed. Detective Turner was able to locate this woman and speak to her, and needless to say, she was quite shocked and overwhelmed by this turn of events. There is no record of Albert's death anywhere, and he was never officially reported missing, as the last time any of his relatives recalled seeing him was sometime in 1963 or 1964, when he would have been 28 or 29 years old. Albert's grandniece, Tina Barrett, said that her family never talked about him that much after he disappeared, but from what she was told about Albert, she suspects that he was a very vulnerable person with mental health issues who may have been on the autism spectrum long before anyone was even aware of what that was. But since Albert hailed from Hamilton, which is located in Butler County, no one knows how his skeletal remains wound up in a drainage ditch in Preble County, located about 25 miles away. Well, what makes this story even stranger are some comments which have been shared by two of Albert's nieces, Denise Frost and Diana Frost Russell, who are the surviving daughters of Albert's brother, George Frost. They both claim that when they were children, there was always a family rumor that Albert had been murdered before he was rolled up in a piece of carpet and left on someone's porch. But unfortunately, since both of Albert's parents and all of his siblings, including George, have passed away, no one has been able to provide additional context about this rumor. And as if this situation wasn't odd enough, it turns out that Albert's older sister, Clara Frost Kaprowski, also vanished without a trace sometime between 1950 and 1952, when she would have been in her early 20s, and of course, there's no record of her ever having been reported missing. At one point, George apparently told his daughters that his mother had sold Clara to a German man, and since her husband, Chester Kaprowski, married Clara when she was still a teenager, I have to assume that he's the German man George was referring to. Clara and Chester had a pair of children named Christine and Joseph, and Chester would get remarried to another woman not long after Clara vanished. It's been reported that Chester was abusive towards Clara during their marriage, so it's not hard to formulate a theory about Clara's disappearance. But both Chester and their two children have since passed away, so we have no real evidence to work with. So yes, there are definitely so many unanswered questions about what actually happened to Albert and Clara. I mentioned earlier that when Albert's remains were found back in 1968, his official cause of death was listed as unknown, and while there were no obvious signs of trauma on his remains to indicate foul play, you have to remember that his entire body was not recovered. After Albert's death certificate is completed, a new investigation will be launched in order to determine if he was the victim of a homicide, and hopefully, they will also make an attempt to try and figure out what happened to Clara. So it seems like the investigation into the disappearance of Mary Jane Van Gilder has uncovered an entirely different rabbit hole, And even though it turned out that the Preble County Jane Doe had no connection to her case, we now have a couple of all new mysteries. But I will say that Detective Adam Turner is one of the most dedicated law enforcement officers I have ever seen, as he believes that all unsolved cold cases should be properly investigated, no matter how old they may be. If anyone can get to the bottom of what happened to Albert Frost, it's him. I also just wanted to mention that during the press conference to announce Albert's identification, Adam gave a shout-out to The Trail Went Cold, as well as all the other podcasts and YouTube shows which put his story into the spotlight, which was a really nice gesture. During the press conference, he made this statement towards Albert, quote, "I am sorry that it took so long to restore your name. It is a shame that you are now more renowned in death than in life. I take solace in the fact that wherever you are, outside the stars, beyond the firmament, that you are with family." End quote. Indeed, it's incredible to think that if Detective Turner had not taken on the Mary Jane Van Gilder case, learned about the Preble County Jane Doe, and took the initiative to exhume this victim, it's possible that no one would have ever found out who Albert Frost was, and he would have been completely lost to history. The last known photograph of Albert was a sophomore picture from his high school yearbook, and we have used that as the cover photo for this episode to ensure he is not forgotten. Anyway, I'll keep you apprised of any further developments in both the Albert Frost and Mary Jane Van Gilder cases. The next case I'll be discussing was featured on episode number 40, which covered the death of a mysterious, unidentified decedent known only as William L. Toomey. As you might recall, this man entered the Sacred Heart Catholic Church in Boise, Idaho on December the 4th, 1982, and ended his own life by swallowing a cyanide capsule. Even though he was carrying a suicide note signed William L. Toomey, it turned out this was not his real name. Unfortunately, Mr. Toomey has still not been identified, but on my episode, I explored the theory that his death might somehow be connected to a murder which took place nearly 1 year earlier. The victim in question was Father Patrick Ryan, a 49-year-old Irish Catholic priest whose nude body was found inside room 126 at the Sand and Sage Motel in Odessa, Texas, on the morning of December the 22nd, 1981. The condition of the room indicated that a violent struggle took place, and Father Ryan was severely beaten and had his hands tied behind his back, with his exact cause of death being a blow to the throat. Ryan's abandoned car was discovered 90 miles away in the parking lot of another motel in Hobbs, New Mexico. It had obviously been driven there by the person who killed him, and Ryan's wallet, as well as an accordion and silver chalice that he always carried in his trunk, were missing. Ryan was the pastor at St. William's Church in Denver City, Texas, which is nearly 90 miles from Odessa, and on the night before his body was found, he had registered at the Sand and Sage Motel under a fake name. The most promising lead was a backpack found in Ryan's apartment, which belonged to a 25-year-old Native American alcoholic drifter named James Harry Reyes. Reyes was soon questioned by police and claimed that Father Ryan had picked him up hitchhiking and took him out drinking. But when Reyes visited the priest's apartment, Ryan forced him to perform oral sex, and Reyes was left so shaken by the experience that he forgot his backpack when he left. Nearly 1 year later, in November of 1982, after getting drunk and taking Quaaludes, Reyes surrendered to police and made a recorded confession to Father Ryan's murder. After he was charged with the crime, Reyes was convicted at trial and received a 38-year prison sentence. However, there was always a lot of controversy surrounding his conviction, as Reyes recanted his confession, and he seemed to have a rock-solid alibi, as there was considerable evidence placing him in Roswell, New Mexico, on the night of Father Ryan's murder. In fact, Reyes' pickup truck had been pulled over for speeding that night, and he received a time-stamped speeding ticket at a spot which was 215 miles away from the Sand and Sage Motel in Odessa. Even if by some miracle, Reyes managed to speed back and forth between Roswell and Odessa in order to commit the murder during a very narrow time frame, he would not have had the opportunity to drive Father Ryan's car to the motel parking lot in Hobbs. Reyes was released from prison on parole in 1995, but was sent back to prison on two separate occasions for parole violations, and in total, he served nearly 24 years behind bars. None of the physical evidence from the murder scene had matched Reyes, and even though he was hoping to prove his innocence, Reyes was informed that while he was in prison, the Odessa Police Department had destroyed their case files and all the evidence, even though this violated their own internal policy. Shortly after I released my Trail Went Cold episode in August of 2017, I actually received a very nice email from Mr. Reyes, who had listened to the episode, and thanked me for keeping his story in the spotlight. Even though he was no longer behind bars, Reyes said that he was still trying to clear his name, but without any physical evidence left to prove his innocence, how would this be possible? Well, this is where the true crime podcast Crime Junkie comes in. Now, if you follow me for a long time, you'll probably know my personal history with Crime Junkie, but I gotta give credit where it's due. They helped pave the way for James Reyes' exoneration. In May of 2021, they released their own episode about Father Ryan's murder, and two people that heard it were a married couple named Harley and Michael Gerke. And wouldn't you know it, they listened to the episode while driving to Odessa, Texas to visit Michael's family, as his father, Michael Gerke Sr., just happens to be the city's current police chief. Of course, the Ryan murder took place many years before Chief Gerke got his job, but after his son and daughter-in-law informed him about the case, he decided to take a fresh look at it and became convinced that a major injustice occurred. Well, even though all the physical evidence had supposedly been destroyed, it turned out that photocopies of the original latent fingerprint cards were still around. Needless to say, none of these prints matched James Reyes, but when they were entered into an automated fingerprint identification system, some of them wound up matching three different men who had criminal records: Bobby Jean Collins, Charles Burkhart, and Gary Ehrman. Collins and Burkhart both lived in Odessa at the time of the murder, and while Ehrman originally hailed from Ohio, he was a known drifter, and his name had actually been listed on the Sand and Sage Motel's registry on December the 21st, 1981. In fact, Ehrman had checked into room 137 only about an hour after Father Ryan arrived and checked into room 126, and according to witnesses, a group of four people held a party in room 137 that night, though by the time Ryan's body was discovered, they were long gone, so police never got the opportunity to question them. Ehrman's fingerprint was on a plastic cup found behind the broken bed in Ryan's room, while Charles Burkhart's print was found in some blood on the front door, and Bobby Jean Collins' fingerprints matched a blood print on the bathroom showerhead. Collins had been a veteran in the Marine Corps who served in Vietnam, but according to his daughter and sister, he became a very violent person after returning home. In fact, Collins' daughter would later say that she believed he killed more people after returning home than he did in Vietnam. Unidentified fingerprints were found on the cruise control on Father Ryan's abandoned car, as well as his credit card, which had been dumped in a nearby trash can. Even though the quality of these prints was not clear enough to make a definitive match, Collins could technically not be eliminated as the source. In addition, a witness had reported seeing a man driving Father Ryan's car the day after the murder and said that he was wearing a Marine Corps cap, which Collins would have owned. These new findings were shared with both the Ector County District Attorney's Office and the Innocence Project of Texas, who agreed to perform a fresh review of the case. In March of 2023, a hearing was held in 70th District Court in Odessa in order to present all the new evidence which supported Reyes' innocence and pointed to Collins, Burkhart, and Ehrman being the real perpetrators. After hearing all this evidence, Judge Den Whalen would eventually issue a 57-page order in which he recommended that the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals officially declare Reyes innocent of the murder of Father Ryan. He wrote, quote, "The court finds that justice cannot prevent this conviction to stand. The evidence of Mr. Reyes' innocence and the evidence of the other's guilt is overwhelming," end quote. On October the 4th, the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals voted 9-0 to uphold Judge Whalen's decision and vacate Reyes' conviction, and just over 1 month later, on November the 7th, the Ector County District Attorney's Office finally dismissed the case and declared Reyes to be factually innocent. Even though he was no longer in prison at this point, Reyes had technically still been a convicted murderer in the eyes of the law, which made it difficult to have a normal life on the outside. He had lived in a transitional housing facility in Austin, and was technically not even allowed to leave the state in order to visit relatives in New Mexico. Reyes also continued to have struggles with alcoholism, but when he heard the news about his exoneration, he made a public vow to remain sober. At age 67, Reyes had finally received vindication, and he referred to the date of his exoneration as the best day of his life, and he is now eligible to receive up to $2 million in compensation for his wrongful conviction. Now, since William L. Toomey's suicide took place a short time after Reyes was charged with Father Ryan's murder, there was speculation that the two events might be connected, but it now seems obvious that the Toomey case is completely unrelated. Since Bobby Jean Collins, Charles Burkhart, and Gary Ehrman are no longer with us, they can obviously never be charged with Father Ryan's murder, and we may never learn the full story of how this came about. Even though he was a murder victim, there is ample evidence that Father Ryan was a sexual predator, who was transferred around by the Catholic Church in order to hide his indiscretions. And given that he was found nude in a motel room 90 miles away from where he lived, Ryan may have planned to meet up there with one or more of his killers for a sexual encounter, but wound up being ambushed, robbed, and killed. It's worth noting that when Ehrman checked into the motel, he was supposedly among a group of four people, so perhaps there was an additional individual involved in this crime who has never been identified. But regardless of whether or not we ever learn the full truth, at least James Reyes has finally been vindicated, and a terrible miscarriage of justice has been corrected. So the next case we're going to talk about is the murder of Ruth Marie Terry, a victim formerly known as the Lady on the Dunes, who was covered way back on episode number 17. On July the 26th, 1974, Ruth's nude body was found at the Race Point Dunes near Provincetown at the northern tip of Cape Cod in Massachusetts. She was lying on a towel, and her head was resting upon some folded clothing, which likely belonged to her. She had been the victim of a particularly brutal murder, as she was killed with a blow to the head which crushed the left side of her skull, and her throat was slashed so deeply that she was nearly decapitated. Her hands and some of her teeth had also been removed, and since she could not be identified, she became known as the Lady of the Dunes for the next 48 years. However, last year, on October the 31st, 2022, it was announced that the Lady of the Dunes had finally been identified as Ruth Marie Terry, who would have been 37 years old at the time of her death. Of course, this identification was made possible when genetic genealogy matched Ruth's DNA to some surviving biological relatives, allowing investigators to figure out who she was. I don't want to repeat myself too much, so if you want to learn more extensive details about Ruth's background, I recommend you listen to my previous update episode. But I just wanted to mention that Ruth was originally born in Whitwell, Tennessee, and while living in Michigan during her early 20s, she gave birth to a son. Since Ruth did not feel that she could financially support the boy on her own, she allowed a married couple she knew to adopt him, and he was raised under the name Richard Hanchett Jr. In 2018, Richard took a DNA test through Ancestry.com in hopes of finding his birth mother, and a genetic match was made to the Terry family. While Richard finally got the opportunity to connect with Ruth's relatives, he was shocked to learn that Ruth had not been seen in 4 decades, and it came as an even bigger surprise 4 years later when he found out that he was the son of the Lady of the Dunes. This past year, Richard and some of Ruth's other relatives traveled to Massachusetts to visit the site where her body had been found, and they also paid their first visit to Ruth's grave at St. Peter's Cemetery in Provincetown. Some of Ruth's remains are still there, while others have been buried alongside Ruth's mother in Tennessee. Richard has also scattered some of his mother's ashes on the beach where she was found, and brought some of her other ashes home with him. Well, even though Ruth finally got her name back, this case was still not completely solved, since investigators wanted to figure out who murdered her, but there was a pretty obvious suspect. While living in California, Ruth became involved in a relationship with a man named Guy Moldovan, and the couple married in February of 1974. They later went to visit Ruth's family in Tennessee, but from their interactions with Guy, they felt he gave off the vibe of being a controlling, possessive person. Since Guy worked as an art dealer, he and Ruth were on a cross-country trip throughout the United States to search for antiques, and Guy mentioned that they might be going to Massachusetts for their honeymoon at some point. However, months later, Guy told Ruth's family that after they returned to California, they got into a fight, so Ruth took off and disappeared. Guy never made any attempt to report Ruth missing, and soon broke off all contact with the Terry family, and they never heard from Ruth again. Guy got remarried to another woman the following year, and died in March of 2002 at the age of 78. Yeah, you can already see the red flags here, but at the time, no one had any idea that Guy Moldovan had once been embroiled in another murder case, which was featured in the book Smoke, Mirrors, and Murder, published by noted true crime author Anne Rule in 2007. 2 decades before he met Ruth, Moldovan had been living in Seattle, Washington under the name Raoul Guy Rockwell, and usually went by the nickname Rocky. He had become involved in a relationship with a woman named Manzanita Mearns, who went by the nickname Manzi, and lived with her 18-year-old daughter from a previous marriage, Dolores Mearns. But in 1960, Manzi and Dolores went missing without explanation, while Rocky skipped town, and he proceeded to divorce Manzi in absentia and marry another woman. Some human remains were eventually found inside a septic tank underneath their house in Seattle, which had been sealed with fresh concrete, and while they were believed to belong to the 2 missing victims, this was long before the era of DNA testing, so it technically could not be proven with absolute certainty. While Rocky was eventually tracked down in New York City and extradited back to Seattle, prosecutors did not feel there was enough evidence to file charges against him for the 2 victims' deaths. Since Rocky had embezzled $10,000 from the mother of his new wife, he did serve 13 months in prison for grand larceny, but sometime after he was released, he changed his name back to Guy Moldovan and started over. Interestingly enough, if you read Smoke, Mirrors, and Murder, it briefly mentions that Moldovan married a woman named Terry in Nevada in February of 1974, as for some reason, Ruth used the pseudonym Terry Marie Vizina on their marriage certificate. But when Anne Rule originally wrote about this, I'm sure she had no inkling that Terry would turn out to be the infamous Lady of the Dunes. While Guy Moldovan was the most obvious suspect in Ruth's murder, would investigators be able to prove it after all this time? Even though DNA profiling has made it possible to conclusively link suspects to unsolved crimes after they're already deceased, it does not appear there was any DNA to work with in this case, as it turned out that the Massachusetts State Police had inexplicably thrown out a lot of the evidence, including Ruth's clothing and the towel, sometime during the 1980s. However, on August the 28th, 2023, after performing an extensive investigation, the Cape and Islands District Attorney's Office announced that this case was officially closed and named Guy Moldovan as Ruth Marie Terry's killer. Now, I previously mentioned that Guy and Ruth had been planning to travel to Massachusetts for their honeymoon, and Guy told her family that after they returned home to California, they got into a fight and she ran off on him. Well, investigators spoke to other witnesses who recalled that when Guy returned to California, he was alone and driving Ruth's car. And instead of telling people that Ruth was missing, he flat out said that she had died. In addition, a private investigator hired by the Terry family would learn that Guy sold off all of Ruth's belongings after she disappeared. Guy also had a connection to the Provincetown area, as his father had owned property there, and in fact, Guy had traveled to Provincetown back when he was a wanted fugitive in 1960. A particularly bizarre piece of evidence which was uncovered during the past year was a cookbook Guy had published in 1976 titled Cooking with Rump Oil. One section contained a recipe titled Cape Cod Shid, and it featured a drawing of a creature with long flowing hair which was disturbingly similar to Ruth's hair at the time she was killed. And next to the drawing was this passage, quote, "Out of the water and into the pan, the only way to cook the shid. After the shid is caught, anything over 5 minutes ends it. The sweet turpentine will turn that of a burnt glove, and the tender look will become one of despair. Remember, just 5 minutes, don't cook the shid out of it," end quote. Well, the book was analyzed by a retired FBI profiler named Julia Cowley, and she believed that Guy was covertly using this passage to describe his own wife's murder. Cowley stated, quote, "What I do wonder, especially the last line, the tender look will become one of despair, you have to think that perhaps was the moment he watched life go out of her eyes, and when she realized he's going to kill me. It's really horrifying." End quote. I never thought I'd say this, but cooking with rump oil almost seems to be a variation of O.J. Simpson's infamous book, If I Did It, but in cookbook form. So yeah, even though we don't have forensic evidence which conclusively proves that Guy Moldovan committed this crime, it's just too much of a coincidence that he likely left on a honeymoon to Massachusetts with Ruth around the exact time she was murdered, and then showed zero concern about her well-being when she supposedly went missing. Looking at Moldovan's history, it seems like he was a serial killer who somehow managed to avoid getting charged with any murders during his lifetime. It seems obvious that he killed Manzi and Dolores Mearns in 1960, but he has also been looked at as a person of interest in the murder of 22-year-old Henry Baird and subsequent disappearance of 17-year-old Barbara Kelly, a crime which took place in Eureka, California on June the 18th, 1950. I talked about this in more detail in my last update episode, but Moldovan happened to be living in the area at the time under his previous name, Raoul Guy Rockwell, and the two victims' clothing was found neatly folded at the murder scene, much like how Ruth's clothing was found when she was killed. So yeah, Guy Moldovan will never face justice for what he did, and we will probably never know how many people he actually harmed. We'll also never know if he always had the intention of killing Ruth when he married her, or if something went horribly wrong during their trip to Provincetown. What makes the situation even stranger is that when Guy got married to his fifth wife, Phyllis Moldovan, in 1975, he managed to stay with her for the next 27 years before he died. Phyllis herself did not actually pass away until 2021, 1 year before all these revelations came to light, so I can only wonder if she ever saw any warning signs with her husband during their marriage. Regardless, at least we can now say with absolute certainty that the murder of Ruth Marie Terry, formerly known as the Lady of the Dunes, has officially been solved. So on our last update episode, we discussed a number of criminal trials for cases from The Trail Went Cold which ended in a verdict, but there were a couple which still hadn't gone to court. One case which did finally have a resolution this year was the disappearance of 21-year-old Bethany Decker, which I covered on episode number 189. But the end results were pretty disappointing. As a recap, Bethany was last confirmed to be alive in Loudoun County, Virginia on January the 29th, 2011, and she was around 3 to 5 months pregnant at the time. Even though she was married and had an infant son, Bethany was carrying on a secret affair with a Bolivian immigrant named Ronald Roldan, and even though this was never conclusively established, he was believed to be the father of her unborn child. Since Ronald was known for being abusive and controlling, he became the prime suspect in Bethany's disappearance, but there was not enough evidence to implicate him. However, in November of 2014, after relocating to North Carolina, Ronald found himself in legal trouble when he violently attacked and attempted to kill his estranged girlfriend, Vicky Willoughby, causing her to lose her right eye. Due to some legal issues with the search warrant, Ronald received a much lighter sentence than he deserved, and after serving 6 years behind bars, he was scheduled to be released in November of 2020 and subsequently deported to his native Bolivia. But before this could take place, Ronald was charged with abduction by force or intimidation in connection with Bethany's disappearance, and after being extradited to Loudoun County, he was indicted with second-degree murder 1 month later. While Bethany's remains had not yet been found, I think the Loudoun County Sheriff's Office wanted to file charges in order to prevent Ronald from being deported. He remained incarcerated for the next 2 years, but last November, it was announced that Ronald had agreed to plead guilty to second-degree murder. When we left our last update episode, Ronald had a sentencing hearing scheduled for February the 21st, 2023, and it went down as planned. As part of his plea agreement, Ronald would be required to go on the record and make a full confession about what happened to Bethany. So he told investigators that on the day Bethany went missing, they got into an argument in their apartment, which led to him pushing Bethany and causing her to fall down and hit her head on the windowsill. Ronald said that when he checked Bethany, he discovered she was dead, but was too panicked to call for help. Instead, he put Bethany's body inside a Christmas tree bag and dumped her inside the trash compactor at their apartment complex. Unfortunately, if Ronald's account was true, then Bethany's remains would have wound up in a nearby landfill, and investigators felt they were unrecoverable and did not launch a search. Bethany's loved ones appeared in court for Ronald's sentencing hearing and made their victim impact statements. Bethany's mother, Kimberly Nelson, would later tell the press, quote, "It was quite tragic for us to go from missing to murdered in just a sentence and a day," end quote. After pleading guilty to second-degree murder, Ronald received the maximum sentence of 40 years in prison. However, all but 12 and a half years of that sentence have been suspended, which means that technically, Ronald will only be in prison for a few months longer than the amount of time Bethany's family spent searching for. Yeah, it goes without saying that this is a pretty disappointing conclusion, particularly since Bethany's remains will never be returned to her family for a proper burial. It's very reminiscent of another case I've discussed on my update episodes, and that's Jose Rodriguez Cruz's conviction for the 2009 murder of Pamela Butler, as he agreed to plead guilty to second-degree murder and only received a 12-year prison sentence, even though he still didn't lead the authorities to her remains. But at least in that case, Jose was later charged with another murder and received an additional sentence, so it's unlikely that he'll ever get out of prison. What adds to the frustration is that the authorities are still pretty skeptical of Ronald's confession and are not so sure that her death was the result of her accidentally falling over and hitting her head. After all, Ronald would later go to the trouble of impersonating Bethany on her Facebook account and leaving posts and comments to fool people into thinking she was still alive. But since investigators really do not have any hard evidence that premeditated murder took place, I guess this plea agreement was the best option for them. When Ronald finishes serving his 12 and a half years, it sounds like he would be deported back to Bolivia, and I suppose that's a better outcome than him being deported before he got charged with this crime. But let's move on to some more satisfying updates. I previously mentioned that our last update episode ended with verdicts in a couple of trials, and wouldn't you know it, two of the defendants who were found guilty have since passed away in prison. And the timing of these events is eerily similar. Way back on episode number 21, I covered the disappearances of 36-year-old Renee McRae and her 3-year-old son, Andrew McRae, who vanished from Inverness, Scotland in November of 1976. The remains have still never been found, but investigators still managed to build a strong circumstantial case against the prime suspect, Bill McDowell, who was finally charged with both murders in September of 2019. There were numerous delays bringing him to trial, partially due to COVID-19, and since McDowell was in very poor health and needed a wheelchair to get around, the whole situation almost felt like a race against the clock. But in September of last year, the trial finally took place, and McDowell was found guilty of both murders and sentenced to a minimum of 30 years in prison. And just under 5 months later, on February the 15th, 2023, McDowell passed away at the age of 81. Another defendant who went on trial last September at almost the exact same time was Alan Lee Phillips, who had been charged with the murders of 29-year-old Bobby Joe Oberholzer and 21-year-old Annette K. Schnee. The crime took place in Breckenridge, Colorado in January of 1982, and is more commonly known as the Orange Sock Murders, and of course, I covered it on episode number 33. Since Phillips was linked to the crime via DNA evidence, it came as no surprise when the jury found him guilty and he received two consecutive life sentences. But he did not last long in prison, as on March the 2nd, 2023, only 2 weeks after Bill McDowell died, it was announced that Phillips had also passed away at the age of 72. While it's a shame that both these murderers got to live the majority of their lives as free men, it is still a very satisfying feeling to know that after believing they had successfully gotten away with it, they ultimately wound up getting caught and died behind bars. Now, we still have two Trail Went Cold cases in which a suspect has been arrested for the crime, but has not yet gone on trial. One of these suspects is Floyd Galloway Jr., who was charged with the murder of 28-year-old Danielle Stislicki, who vanished from Southfield, Michigan on December 2, 2016, and was covered by our podcast on Minisode number 22. Even though Danny's remains have still not been found, Galloway was charged with premeditated first-degree murder in March of 2019, and he is also currently serving a 16- to 35-year prison sentence for a completely unrelated attack and attempted sexual assault of another woman. You might be wondering why it's taken nearly 5 years to bring Galloway to trial, but when we left off our last update episode, there was a lot of drama going on behind the scenes. Last November, a circuit court judge ruled that some of the evidence the state had gathered against Galloway, such as Danny's keys and her Fitbit, would have to be suppressed at his trial. Long story short, the search warrants used to obtain this evidence were based on information gathered from a private polygraph test which had been arranged by Galloway's defense attorney. Since the polygraph examiner shared the information from this test with police, this technically violated attorney-client privilege as well as Galloway's due process rights. When I shared my last update, Galloway's trial was scheduled for March of 2023, but not surprisingly, this situation has caused more delays. Back in September, the Michigan Court of Appeals upheld the lower court's decision to suppress the aforementioned evidence, though they did rule that some other evidence involving Danny's cell phone records can be used at Galloway's trial, since they were obtained with different search warrants which had been executed before the privileged information from the polygraph test was shared with police. I'm not sure if a new trial date has been set, but hopefully it takes place at some point during 2024, though this debacle with the polygraph test has caused a lot of anxiety about how well the case against Galloway will hold up. But at the very least, he will continue to remain behind bars, as Galloway's earliest possible release date for his attack on the other woman is not until 2033. And finally, we have to talk about Michael Jefferson's arrest for the murder of 51-year-old Roger Dean, which took place in Littleton, Colorado on November 21, 1985, and was featured on episode number 128 of The Trail Went Cold. After genetic genealogy helped link DNA evidence from the crime scene to Jefferson, it was announced that he had been charged with first-degree murder back in April of 2021. But unfortunately, there has been absolutely nothing released to the media since Jefferson's arrest nearly 3 years ago. I have to assume there are a number of things going on behind the scenes, but the only reason I know the status of Jefferson's upcoming trial is because I keep checking the Colorado Judicial Branch court docket website. I can tell you that Jefferson's trial has been delayed multiple times for reasons that have never been made public, and at the end of our last update episode, I said that the case was scheduled to go to court in February of 2023. But delays have kept occurring, and at the time of this recording, the court docket website lists the trial's projected start date as February 5th, 2024. The murder of Roger Dean is such a bizarre case, with so many unanswered questions, so I've just been chomping at the bit to learn more details about what happened, and I hope this trial takes place sooner rather than later. I'll definitely keep you posted on any developments involving Michael Jefferson and Floyd Galloway throughout the coming year. So we're going to close off this episode by talking about a trio of cases which have not yet been solved, but have recently had some very interesting developments. One of them is a missing children's case from our podcast's home country of Canada, and that's the disappearance of 13-year-old Noreen Greenlee, which I covered on episode number 190. Noreen lived in Bowmanville, Ontario, and on September 14, 1963, she left her best friend's house and was last seen heading towards the bus stop in order to get a ride back home, but by the time the bus arrived, Noreen had vanished without a trace. Now, on the surface, all the evidence seemed to point towards Noreen being the victim of an abduction. A witness had reported seeing a girl matching Noreen's description climbing into a blue car being driven by an unidentified man wearing a black fedora. A few minutes later, Noreen's younger sister and two other witnesses were walking down the road when they nearly got sideswiped by a blue car which sped past them. They thought they heard a female screaming from inside the vehicle, leading to speculation that if Noreen was in the midst of being abducted, she may have attempted to grab the wheel and cause the car to swerve in an attempt to capture her sister's attention. In recent years, investigators have looked into a tip provided by a man who believed that his deceased father may have killed Noreen and placed her body inside the trunk of his car before burying it in a large hole during a construction project that was taking place back in 1963. But even though an excavation was performed in the area where this vehicle was supposedly buried, nothing was found. Regardless, I still suspected that Noreen was likely the victim of foul play, but on September the 14th of this past year, in order to commemorate the 60th anniversary of Noreen's disappearance, the Durham Regional Police held a press conference about the case and put forward a surprising new theory. According to investigators, Noreen's father, Harvey Greenlee, had come forward to police in 1968 and shared some new information which suggested that Noreen might have disappeared voluntarily. However, since Harvey tragically died of a brain aneurysm a short time later, it seems like this new information was forgotten about for 55 years until the Durham Regional Police uncovered an old memo book where a former Bowmanville police constable had taken down notes about what Harvey told him. Believe it or not, even though she was only 13 years old, it's possible that Maureen may have been pregnant at the time she went missing. I have no idea where this information originated from, but the story goes that Noreen may have taken off to the nearby city of Oshawa and hid there for 2 weeks. Afterwards, she went to the city of Whitby and stayed there for 3 weeks with a couple named Mary and Gary Benson. There was supposedly another girl staying with Noreen who may have been a friend of hers, and the Bensons made arrangements for both of them to travel across the border to Rochester, New York. They made a trip on a 40-foot cabin cruiser named the Mary Bell, which was captained by a man named Franco, and after she arrived in New York State, Noreen spent time staying at a motel or some cabins in Syracuse before she eventually gave birth to a baby boy. It's unclear what happened next, but Maureen may have decided to remain in the United States and continued living out her life. The notes in the memo book also made mention of the name Bert Quinney, and the Durham Regional Police also said that they were looking into 5 phone numbers which were listed on an old, long-distance card that they had obtained from Bell Canada. Some of Noreen's surviving relatives were present at this press conference, and they expressed hope that the release of this new information might compel someone to come forward if they knew what happened to Noreen. Well, needless to say, this whole development has completely thrown me for a loop. Unfortunately, since Harvey Greenlee passed away shortly after he spoke with police in 1968, I have no idea where he heard this story about Noreen being pregnant and running away. I have to assume that the constable who took down this information has also passed away, so it's unclear if he ever investigated these leads. Needless to say, a teenage girl becoming pregnant would have been a major scandal back in 1963, and hell, given that Noreen was only 13, this would still be a major scandal today. If this story is true, I have no idea who the father of Noreen's unborn child could have been, but if he was a much older adult, then I'm sure every effort was made to keep this whole thing under wraps. It's interesting how Harvey was able to provide specific names and places, which suggests that he didn't just hear simple, uncorroborated rumors and gossip. If Noreen did give birth to a boy in New York, I'm not sure if she gave the child up or decided to raise him, but either way, I can still understand her reluctance to return home and face her family. If she decided to remain in the U.S. and start a new life, then it is possible she could still be alive today at the age of 73. Or, much like Mary Agnes Moroney, she may have passed away of natural causes while living under a new identity, and no one has been able to put two and two together. Whatever the case, I hope these new revelations might help lead to conclusive answers about what happened to Noreen. And of course, I'll keep you apprised of any further updates. So now we're going to talk about a recent development in the unsolved disappearance of 22-year-old Trevor Dealey, which took place in Ireland and was featured on episode number 61. Trevor worked in the IT department at the Bank of Ireland Asset Management in Dublin, and at around 3:35 a.m. on December the 8th, 2000, after attending an office Christmas party, Trevor stopped by his workplace in order to borrow a large golf umbrella. Since it was raining outside, Trevor wanted to use the umbrella for his walk back to his apartment, but he never made it there, and the last time he was confirmed to be alive was at 4:14 a.m. when he passed by a CCTV camera at a Bank of Ireland ATM located on Haddington Road. The most prominent lead in this case involved a mysterious figure known only as the Man in Black, as the CCTV footage showed him passing by the ATM camera 30 seconds after Trevor walked out of the frame. Since he appeared to be heading in Trevor's direction, there was speculation that the Man in Black may have been involved in his disappearance. Even though the Gardaí, which is the official name for Ireland's police force, issued a public plea for this guy to come forward, he never did. But earlier this month, right before the 23-year anniversary of Trevor's disappearance, it was announced that the Man in Black had finally been identified. Details about how they found him are vague, but the Gardaí had recently hired the service of a UK-based company who specialized in the forensic examination and enhancement of photographic and video images, and they apparently did an excellent job at enhancing the quality of the CCTV footage from the ATM camera. This seemed to pave the way to the Man in Black's identification, and he has since spoken to the Gardaí, who publicly announced that the man was not intentionally following Trevor, and they are satisfied that he had no involvement in his disappearance. But frustratingly, it turns out this guy did actually provide a statement to the Gardaí during the early stages of the investigation, but for whatever reason, it seemed to be overlooked and forgotten about for over two decades. It's also worth mentioning that when Trevor first arrived at the Bank of Ireland Asset Management Headquarters at 3:35 a.m., CCTV footage showed him briefly speaking to another man dressed in black who was standing near the rear gate, and this man walked out of the frame shortly after Trevor went inside. For years, there was speculation that this might have been the same man seen in the ATM CCTV footage 40 minutes later, but the Gardaí have confirmed that they are entirely different people. So while there's nothing to indicate that the first man in black seen outside the bank was involved in Trevor's disappearance, investigators would still like to track him down and question him in order to rule him out as a suspect. Trevor's family has described the identification of the second man in black as a quote-unquote bittersweet moment, because even though it has finally closed the books on the case's biggest lead, it has essentially put the investigation right back to square one. But these developments do keep Trevor's case in the spotlight, and hopefully his loved ones will receive answers someday. And finally, I want to talk about the murder of 38-year-old Patrice Endress, which was covered on episode number 199, and of course, it was featured in an episode of the first season of the Unsolved Mysteries reboot on Netflix. As you might recall, Patrice went missing while working at the hair salon she owned in Forsyth County, Georgia, on April the 15th, 2004, and her skeletal remains were discovered 18 months later in a wooded area behind a church located 6 miles away. If you watched the Unsolved Mysteries episode, you'll probably remember the interview with Patrice's husband, Rob Endress, who made a very memorable impression, to say the least. There has always been speculation that Rob may have been involved in Patrice's murder, and he had a very contentious relationship with Patrice's son, Pistol, who was her child from a previous relationship. In fact, the day after Patrice went missing, Rob changed the locks at their house and kicked Pistol out, without even letting him collect his personal possessions. After Patrice's remains were found and cremated, Rob caused even more friction by holding on to her ashes and not allowing Pistol or anyone else from Patrice's family to have access to them. During his Unsolved Mysteries interview, Rob seriously weirded everyone out by saying that he slept and snuggled with Patrice's ashes because she was, quote-unquote, like my teddy bear. There was also a very weird scene where Rob went into the closet, pulled out a cardboard box containing the ashes, and displayed them to the camera crew. Because, you know, it's common practice for people to keep their loved one's ashes in a box inside a closet rather than on display in an urn. Well, there haven't been any new developments in the investigation into Patrice's murder, but it was recently announced that on October the 3rd, 2023, Rob Endress passed away at the age of 77. As a result, Patrice's ashes were finally returned to her family. Now, there's been a lot of debate about whether or not Rob was responsible for Patrice's murder, and if he was the sole perpetrator, there's nothing else that can really be done to solve this case. However, I've personally never been so sure that Rob did it, and if he was involved, I think it's more likely that he orchestrated a murder for hire, meaning that the individual who killed Patrice might still be out there somewhere. Or alternatively, Rob was not involved at all, and his death may allow investigators to put all their focus on other leads. Whatever the case, even if Patrice never receives justice, at least her loved ones can take some comfort in the fact that they finally have her ashes back. Anyway, that about brings an end to The Trail Went Cold's fourth special update episode, and if you would like to get in touch, feel free to send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. Over the past 5.5 years, our Patreon page has released dozens of exclusive bonus episodes, which are all currently available in our archives for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3. This past month, I released an episode about the disappearances of two men named Mel Wilson and Richard Lepsey, as their respective families have explored the possibility that one of these men may have gone on to become the infamous unidentified hijacker known only as D.B. Cooper. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spin-off podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss the 2006 disappearance of Maureen Fields. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and we now have nearly 60 of these commentary tracks in our archives. I also just wanted to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Rhiannon J, DJ, and Catherine H. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to mention that if we manage to reach our goal of 500 Patreon subscribers by the end of 2023, we will provide an additional extra special bonus to all of our patrons in January. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. So we're slowly creeping up on our 8-year anniversary as a podcast, and this statement bears repeating. The fact that our featured cases have generated enough material for not one, not two, not three, but 4 update episodes has greatly surpassed our expectations. What can I say? 2023 has been yet another amazing year for solving cold cases, and I'm sure this will not be our last update episode, and we may wind up doing this again at the end of 2024. So I hope you folks have a happy new year and join us next Wednesday as we return to our regular format and present 2024's first brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.